Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. We will hear again from Jim Zimmerman today. He's talking about the teachers who had such strong influences on his life, among them Aldo Leopold, Norman Fassett, Paul Olson, and Lowell Noland. For anyone who feels they want to make a positive impact on others in this world, here is a good teacher. We will also hear of Jim's involvement in keeping the Kickapoo River from being dammed north of Lafarge. I'm reading from A Field by Sumner Madison, published by Little Creek Press at Mineral Point. We continue with Jim's discussion of Lowell Noland. If you haven't heard the prior readings about Jim, I encourage you to look up the podcasts archived on the WDRT website and look for numbers 14 and 20. At the university, I took freshman zoology in 1943, and Lowell taught us that course. He was probably the finest teacher I ever had in that he was a stickler for good work, but at the same time he had the milk of human kindness, more than anyone I ever met. Noland was so understanding. If there were students having trouble, he'd have them in and talk to them personally. Leopold and Fassett did this too. I saw a lot in common among the three. Everything was fresh and new and creative all the time, and it was important for my own development to be with people who were so creative. Also, there was almost a religious feeling about nature and natural resources. They all had very strong convictions, and they knew how to communicate and to think. Leopold liked to smoke his pipe while pondering matters and then come up with an idea. He would do this at his seminars. He'd puff a while as a student was presenting his report, and then he'd jump up and say, "Is this what you mean?" He'd write it on the board and get all excited about it. Something had clicked, and he had to share his discovery with other people. In 1956, Nolan asked me to teach in his integrated liberal studies program in biology. Since I really didn't want to stay narrowly in botany anyway, I jumped at the chance. That was a real eye-opener because now I could teach under a good teacher, which was even better than having been a student under him. We'd have our weekly conferences on how the course was going and what we should do each week. There were several other good teaching assistants working for him, so I interacted with some very fine people. We'd all have suggestions to make things better. He was very funny because he'd say, "Well, I'll think about it." He wouldn't agree, but he'd come back the next day and we'd find that he had incorporated all of our suggestions to problems. He not only made us happy, but inspired us to work with him because he was so considerate. Noland hardly got any sleep. He was up half the night thinking about different problems and approaches to problems, and he'd get up early in the morning just to keep up each day. When I got my Ph.D., he paid me the ultimate compliment by asking me to take his place and run that course because he was retiring. I had to make an agonizing decision. I declined because I wanted to work outdoors. Although this was a fine biology course, the nicest course I'd ever taught in, it didn't leave much time for outdoor work that I wanted. Many people didn't understand why I instead took the job as a naturalist in the Madison School Forest and at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. There was less prestige attached to that position in the eyes of certain people on campus. You see, what I value most about my work as a naturalist is reaching other people, turning them on, getting them interested in nature. If I can get people involved, I feel satisfied, because I feel I'm helping people enjoy a more enriched life. The hope is that they would then become more involved and more responsible inhabitants of the planet. It's a matter of getting one naturalist per so many 100 people everywhere, and you would have most of our environmental problems solved. This was Paul Olson's idea. He had me teach May Thielgard Watt's Reading the Landscape of America for 10 years as part of the Madison School Forest program, and it became extremely popular. We figured we reached 2,000 people in 10 years, many of whom are now business people and doctors on city councils and county boards. I've concluded that people's interests are more emotional than rational, and if you give people an emotional experience, they will carry away more and have more interest and involvement than if you give them some kind of intellectual experience. I've had so many good experiences outdoors that I want other people to have these same experiences, but I want them to develop their own philosophy, not because I think they should, but because they can't fail to develop an ecological attitude toward the land if they have contact hours in the field. I've directed my efforts to help people acquire those contact hours one way or another. I believe I have to be half scientist and half artist. Science and art are very close. The artist is generally perceived to be more spontaneous and the scientist more methodical. Everything planned for the next 20 years. Well, scientists aren't like that, and artists aren't so flighty either. A good artist does a lot of planning, and a good scientist does a lot of creative thinking. So there really is no significant difference between science and art. They're both trying to get at the truth. But institutionalized science is anathema to most art-oriented people, and vice versa. It's one of those typical splits of human nature, like between the managers and the ivory tower researchers. Neither one understands the other. They think the other is no darn good. If you can't be a good communicator, you're only a narrow specialist. It's better to be a jack of all trades so you can put into perspective what the specialists say, and I know which specialist to go to if I need more knowledge and how to adapt what they advise. And to be an effective naturalist, you have to have a grasp of the physical and biological sciences, as well as to be an adept communicator. Supposedly, being a good communicator ought to happen if you're a good observer, a good synthesizer, because I regard human nature as part of nature. If you're sensitive to one part, you ought to be sensitive to all of nature. Sensitivity, however, requires two steps: perceiving with your senses, good ears, eyes, nose, and so on, and perceiving with your heart. If you're receptive to what's going on around you, then you should be as receptive to people and their feelings as you are to a bird, a plant, the wind, the clouds, or whatever. But that takes some training, and you have to get into the right mental position. You have to bore a hole from inside out until it reaches the holes on the outside coming in, so that you make connections. One of the interesting things Leopold tried to do in his seminars was to have state land managers attend along with his students. He had to work hard to keep them working together, but it made a nice cross-fertilization of different points of view. And I'll read one final passage from this chapter. Regarding a land ethic, there's one fight to preserve land I'd like to mention. In the early 1970s, there was a proposed dam impoundment in the Kickapoo River Canyon of west-central Wisconsin's Driftless area. There was a proposal by the United States Army Corps of Engineers to control flooding and create a lake for recreation in the Kickapoo Valley. But a University of Wisconsin study clearly showed that the project had a low benefit-cost ratio. There were many flaws in the estimated benefits, and the area contained outstanding geologic and botanical features that could be destroyed by such a project. When I first learned of it and talked to people who were trying to prevent the dam, it seemed pretty hopeless. But after canoeing the river, I realized that there was much more at stake. This was a real jewel. I began to get angry. I organized a small group to contact senators and get other people involved. Finally, through the help of Senator Gaylord Nelson's assistant in Washington, we got Nelson out here and then commanded more attention from Washington. I took an ecology class to the Kickapoo 3 years in a row, and in each of those years we canoed, camped overnight in Wildcat Mountain State Park, and invited the Army Corps of Engineers to present their side of the story. The Corps always sent two people, so we couldn't convert one of them to our cause. One of the people they sent was a biologist. It was almost a different person each year because the biologists were driven crazy by the Corps of Engineers' approach to things. The third year, things were getting pretty close to the wire, and the third biologist they sent us was clever. He took me aside and told me, "You know, if you really want to fight this thing, the new endangered species law has just been enacted. If you think there are any endangered plants down there, you ought to work up that angle. Because as owner of much of the land, the Corps is responsible for the welfare of any endangered species." So I thanked him, made a list, and got six professors to sign a legal affidavit. We sent it to Washington saying that certain plants should be considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act, and if they were so designated, the Corps had to include them in an environmental impact statement. The Endangered Species Act was particularly restrictive for public agencies, and so this was important to our efforts, although it probably constituted only 10% of the effective opposition to the dam. But the dam was halted. Discussion of a dry dam followed, but without a lake for recreation, the cost-benefit ratio was even lower than that from the original plan. And we succeeded in preserving this marvelous area. And finally, Sumner Madison's words end the chapter. On September 28, 1992, while working alone on prairie restoration at their Red Cedar Lake country home near Cambridge, Wisconsin, Jim Zim, as his students affectionately called him, suffered a massive heart attack and dropped to the earth, face down, and quickly passed away. He was 67. Of the moment, Libby wrote, "A small man lay on the ground, but a giant has fallen." In 2003, James Hall Zimmerman was inducted into the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. This is Maggie Jones. Thank you for listening.